It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Trump administration is drafting an executive order targeting rising drug prices. We'll talk about why some prescription medications can get so expensive.
First, the Department of Corrections in the state has been under investigation for the last 2 years for alleged abuses at both the Lincoln Hill School for Boys and the Copper Lake School for Girls, two juvenile detention facilities based in Irma.
The alleged practices include the use of extreme force and solitary confinement on teenage inmates. A federal judge ruled on Friday that the State Department of Corrections will need to dramatically reduce those practices.
Molly Beck joins us now. She's a state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal and has been covering the Lincoln Hill story. Molly, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, what did the judge call for in this ruling?
So this ruling is part of a larger case. Involving the use of solitary confinement, restraints, and pepper spray on the teen inmates at the Lincoln Hills Prison in Irma. And the plaintiffs, which are represented by the ACLU, they requested that the judge say right now, even though the case isn't finished, that the prison must stop using those practices because they violate, they say they violate their constitutional rights. To be protected from cruel and unusual punishment. So the judge agreed that the plaintiffs made a good case and said that he didn't want to stop it immediately like they asked, but he did want the Department of Corrections and the plaintiffs to come up with an agreement on what they can do to change what they're doing there.
And specifically, what did he call for in terms of looking at what can be done to curb some of these practices that you mentioned?
He set some parameters, so he didn't leave it just, you know, to the DOC and to the plaintiffs to just come up with one plan without any kind of guidelines. So he said that he wants DOC to stop putting the inmates in solitary confinement for, you know, sometimes months. He doesn't want that to happen anymore. He wants that to be no more. If they're sent to solitary confinement, they can't be there for longer than 7 days. He wants DOC staff to, analyze on a case-by-case basis whether these inmates need to be shackled at their hands and at their feet when they're, for example, in class or eating. And he also, he said that he wants the pepper spray use to be reduced or eliminated, but he said he didn't think that the staff at the Lincoln Hills Prison were trained to do anything else, to kind of manage behavior. He was very critical of the kind of training and education that the people in charge there have, and said he doesn't believe that they're capable at this point to come up with an alternative.
And Judge Peterson, he had some strong words as he was announcing his ruling. He used the word callous several times, and it sounds like he even compared the conditions for some inmates at Lincoln Hills to the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski.
Right. Yeah, he said that some of the inmates there are in more restrictive confinement than the Unabomber, in his view. And, of course, the Unabomber's at a supermax prison for adults right now. He also said that, you know, he was asked to determine whether these inmates' constitutional rights were violated because of a kind of a willful act on the part of DOC staff. And he said that, you know, a callous indifference to him is the same. You know, he didn't believe that DOC staff were, you know, out to get these inmates, so to speak, but they knew that what they're doing is potentially permanently harmful. And even though they know that, they're still continuing these practices. So he said it's not enough to just want to do something differently. You have to do something differently, was his point.
We're talking to Molly Beck right now, state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and she joined us today to talk about a judge's recent ruling on the conditions at the Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake youth prisons. And for their part, what did the DOC have to say about some of these topics, about shackling and pepper spray and the use of solitary?
Yeah, they had the prison administrator, Wendy Peterson, there to testify, and also the new director of security, Brian Gusky, who that position oversees disciplinary procedures like the pepper spray and the solitary confinement. And their testimony was, you know, mostly about why they're doing it. And they both acknowledged that they didn't think the practices were good for teenagers. Brian Geske said that, you know, staffing has been pretty problematic since he's been there, which was in July. He was hired in July of 2016. And, you know, they've had unpredictable staffing. It's difficult to find guards to want to work in the, quote, solitary confinement housing units. Wendy Peterson, who has been there a lot longer, she said after these state and federal investigations began, it became pretty difficult to keep and retain and attract staff. And at some points they had 20% vacancies there. So they kind of, you know, said that they want to do things differently, but it's pretty difficult when they don't have enough people to do so.
And it sounds like officials at the DOC working at these facilities also made the case that there are reform efforts underway and that it was possible that a judge's ruling like the one that was handed down could interfere with the way things are progressing in terms of the DOC handling those problems itself already.
Right. Yeah. After Secretary John Letcher was hired back, you know, he had been there previously, and then after these investigations began, the former secretary, he left, and a number of other people overseeing juvenile corrections left. And when he came in, he put forward a number of things that he wanted to do differently. And they've, you know, I spoke with him recently, and they, whatever they're doing has reduced, you know, for example, the number of female inmates hurting themselves, which was definitely a problem a few years ago, and that number has decreased. But, you know, the number of times pepper spray has been used in the judge's view, that is still too much, you know, as recent as April. So the judge said, yes, I understand that you're putting forward reforms, but he wasn't convinced that they were actually taking hold fast enough. He also said that he wasn't sure that, you know, the kinds of changes that need to be made could be made with the staff there right now.
And Molly, it sounds like there's still a long ways to go in terms of investigations and other lawsuits. Can you tell us what's still out there for Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake?
Sure. There's three federal lawsuits. This is one of them. Obviously the investigation that the FBI is heading, no one really knows where that is at this point. The last time I spoke with the Secretary Litcher, he said he hasn't heard from them in a long time. He doesn't know, you know, whether charges are pending against some of the staff within Department of Corrections and at Lincoln Hills. We have a new president now, so there's a new prosecutor looking at this. So it's kind of unclear where all that stands. The lawsuits, they're going to go through, you know, the court process. And there was one lawsuit that was filed and an inmate received a monetary award. But it's unclear, you know, where the other lawsuits will go. Based on the judge's comments last week, he believes that the constitutional rights of these inmates likely were violated. So, you know, changes are already afoot in that lawsuit or because of that lawsuit. So we'll see where that goes.
And any word yet about whether the state will appeal?
They said that it was too soon to say whether they will. That was kind of on my to-do list to check in on that today. But I haven't heard whether they'll do that or not.
And Governor Walker weighed in on this. What did he have to say?
His office said that, you know, and they've said this many times, that they're confident in Secretary John Litcher's plan to make changes there. That's pretty common from Governor Walker's office. They have said all along that they trust him and think that he'll be the person that will be able to make sure things run the way they need to there.
Molly, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Molly Beck, State Capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, joining us today to talk about Judge Peterson's recent ruling on the conditions at the Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake youth prisons.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
President Trump promised that he would bring down drug prices in the earliest days of his administration. But the New York Times reports that a draft of the executive order targeting prescription drug prices shows no promise of lower costs for consumers.
Reports say that some of the proposals in the draft of the order have actually been backed by the pharmaceutical industry, and it could do more to help them than consumers.
Doug Hirsch joins us now to tell us what goes into drug pricing. He's co-founder and co-CEO of GoodRx, a website and mobile app that tracks prescription drug prices and offers coupons for medications. Doug, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into policy on this, what is it right now that makes some drugs, not all drugs, but some drugs so expensive and their prices go up apparently so dramatically?
It's true. Brand drugs are often determined by the manufacturer themselves, right? Brand manufacturers will talk to you about the cost to develop a drug and to market a drug. And, you know, since there's only one supplier, they effectively set that drug, and there aren't a lot of legislative or other requirements that stop that manufacturer from charging whatever it is they think the market will bear. However, for generic drugs, which make up about 90% of the drugs that consumers take, those prices actually have very little to do with the cost of the drug often, and actually have more to do with the very complicated relationships between pharmacies and pharmacy benefit managers. Those are the insurance companies that control your drug costs.
And as I understand it, some of the drugs, when we read reports of a drug cost going way up, a lot of times it may be generic. Multiple companies could produce that drug, but for whatever reason, only one company does. So they get to call the shots when it comes to prices. Is that right, at least for some of the stories we see in the news?
Exactly right. I mean, you know, in any market for any product, when you have multiple people competing, you're going to see that the price tends to go down. And when there's no competition, the price goes up. And, you know, it is a free market, prescriptions are. And while there are other influences, whether it be insurance or Medicare or other factors that can affect the price, the reality is when you have a monopoly on something, you can charge a big, big number for it.
So what are some of the solutions people have talked about for those particular drugs that are so high in price?
Yeah, I mean, so obviously, you know, manufacturers have control over those. There hasn't been, we have a lot of legislation, which we can talk about today, to try to impose some sort of controls, whether that be governmental force control or else just expose pricing more so that consumers have a dialogue to discuss it. There's been, you know, more and more outrage, as you guys are aware, when someone charges $50,000 for a drug. Finally, you know, there's been press and there's been sort of negative repercussions. And so I think that's one of the few things that we have available to us, is to sort of shame drug companies into charging a more realistic price for their prescriptions.
What kind of legislation has floated around out there on those medications?
Well, you know, we saw today that it looks like any changes to the ACA are pushed back until at least, July or farther. And then, of course, we have this executive order that was theoretically going to attempt to drop the cost of drugs, but we don't see a lot in it that actually seems to have that impact.
Yeah, what is in that executive order? Again, this is a draft. This is not the real deal as of yet, but what were some of the key points there?
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like it was going after a number of things that were not sort of the issues we would have expected, right? I mean, the one thing that we heard over and over again throughout the campaign from both Trump and Clinton were they wanted to allow Medicare to negotiate and allow government agencies to be able to effectively, you know, use their weight and their negotiating power to bring down the cost of the drug. And that's the one thing that we don't see at all in this draft version of the order. Instead, we see them sort of targeting the funds going to 340B, which are the programs for the least affluent people, where it looks like they're actually going to reduce the funding to 340B, which would ultimately just result in higher cost to consumers. So I'm not seeing a lot right now that actually would help decrease that cost. I think I agree with what you said, which it might actually increase the cost.
One of the measures in that executive order would protect drug companies, aims to protect drug companies' intellectual property rights in other countries. So where we see drugs being sold for cheaper right now, it would give, in theory, drug companies more control over those pricing. Is that right?
100%. And so, you know, again, we're, as a company that focuses on making sure Americans can afford their prescriptions, we're left struggling to find the silver lining here. It seems like it's going to make it even harder for consumers to have other options or find other ways to control the cost of their prescriptions.
Another issue I see raised sometimes with those brand name drugs is the brand name drug is out there. the deadline is coming up where it becomes open for other companies to produce, but then the company makes a small change, maybe in the delivery of that medication or the dosage, something like that, and is able to extend its protected status, its monopoly status on that. Is that something that's been coming up in either this executive order draft or in Congress?
You know, I have not seen a lot of mention or any specific focus on those issues. And those are the issues, as you said, that are bringing up some of these just crazy, crazy price increases where, again, you know, companies are getting smart and they're realizing, hey, if I, you know, have a drug that I'm about to lose patent on, I'll just, you know, reformulate. I've heard a story about a drug where they added a wet wipe to it at one point, and then they called it a new drug and charged, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars for it. You get really crazy examples where companies are basically just pulling that drug and reissuing it to keep that patent for another 12 years.
Let's talk about that Medicare reimbursement angle that, as you say, it wasn't mentioned in the executive order. As I understand it, Congress would actually have to get into the act on that, too. Is that something that would really bring down prices? Would it maybe bring down prices for the Medicare system but not affect anybody buying it on the private market? How would that shape the market?
Yeah, it would have a huge impact on the market because, first of all, about 40% of Americans get their prescriptions through some sort of federally funded program. And so if you enable not just Medicare but other federal agencies to be able to use their weight, right, and to be able to basically say to drug companies, hey, I'm not going to buy this drug unless it's more fair priced, I think you'd see a tremendous impact. And I think that impact would trickle down across other, into private insurance and to uninsured Americans as well, where they would, you'd see some sort of parity across the various markets where consumers, whether they have private insurance or uninsured or Medicare, would ultimately benefit from just drugs that come in at a lower price.
We're talking to Doug Hirsch from the company GoodRx, looking at prescription drug pricing, a possible executive order on the way from President Trump, looking at various issues in what sets drug prices. Doug, what is a consumer to do? I think most people, if they're paying out of pocket, they go. If they get prescribed a drug, they pay the price the person tells them to pay, or they don't get the drug at all, I guess. Is there room for maneuver for consumers?
Yeah, so, you know, it used to be a few years ago that consumers had insurance and they thought everything is good and I don't have to worry about my drug price. I just pay my $10 copay and that's it. The reality is that, you know, insurance has really scaled itself back a lot. And today consumers are seeing outrageous prices for even cheap generics where, you know, a drug that should cost $5 to $10 can cost $200 because their insurance just simply won't cover it. And because of the weird nature of our healthcare system, you end up paying $200 for something that should cost $5. And so really it's not a question of, oh, you know, I have insurance, I'm good, or I'm not insured and I have an issue. It's the underinsured of America, which is the vast majority of folks who need to do their research. And what we do is we gather billions of prices at every pharmacy across the country, as well as various discounts, which are often lower than your copay, and bring them together so a consumer can basically understand what they're supposed to pay for this prescription.
What is transparency like? Do we as consumers have the information we need, apart from the information you're gathering there? Can we see what we need to assess whether this is a reasonable price or not?
That's the problem. Is there's never really been a language around prescription drug pricing, right? You know, you go to the doctor, you get a prescription. The doctor doesn't talk about it. He just wants you to take what he thinks is best for you. You show up at the pharmacy, you get sticker shock. And so, you know, GoodRx has taken great pains to bring together this information so a consumer knows prior to showing up at the pharmacy what this drug's going to cost so they can talk to their doctor and say, hey, you know, maybe $500 is not the right option. Is there a lower cost drug? Is there a discount available? Is there a manufacturer copay card? There's many, many options available to consumers to bring down the cost of that drug, but it only works if you know about it.
I've heard proposals, I've heard this idea floated for something called value-based drug pricing. What is that?
Yeah, so the idea of value-based pricing is basically to look at the effectiveness of the drug, right? And to say, okay, well, you know, if I, as an insurance company, am going to give you access to this drug or make it inexpensive for you, what is the long-term impact on your health? The challenge is that that's not how the U.S. healthcare system is really set up. The U.S. healthcare system, you know, if I'm your employer right now and I worry about your healthcare today, I might not be worried about what its impact is on you when you're 70 or 80. And so, you know, if we had a single-payer system in this country where it was ultimately the same person, aka the government, who was keeping their eye on you, then they would be incentivized to keep you healthy now. I think it's a great idea. I'm just concerned that the financial motivations are not in place for your current insurance company to care about your health maybe 20 or 30 years from now.
Another argument people have been having is the idea of importing drugs, allowing imports from other countries that, in theory, American consumers could get cheaper than is currently available. Is that something that would actually have an impact?
That's a fun topic. I think for brand drugs, there's tremendous upside in using other countries to create competition and to basically try to level the playing field, because brand drugs are so expensive in America relative to other countries. On the generic side, what most Americans don't know is actually oftentimes generic drugs are cheaper in the U.S. than they are in, say, Canada, because of the competition and because of the sort of unregulated market that we have. And so, again, generic drugs make up over 80% of the prescriptions Americans take. So for your generics, I'd stay close to home and just see what options exist outside of your copay. But for brands, it would be a tremendous help to the U.S. population.
On the flip side of all this is the pharmaceutical industry. You mentioned earlier they need revenue coming from something to do R&D and do, you know, pursue a lot of blind alleys. Ultimately, a lot of research that they do never ends up in medication. If we're too successful at lowering the money going to them, do we end up killing the goose that lays the golden egg, i.e. the medications we rely on?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge that we have as a country is not necessarily that there's one bad actor. It's we have a situation where we have drug companies who are motivated to make as much profit for their shareholders. We have PBMs or insurance companies who are motivated to make as much profit for their shareholders. We have companies and plans who are trying to save as much money as possible for their patients or employees. And so, unfortunately, it's sort of the natural outcome of the system. When everyone's motivated to make or save as much money as possible, you end up with what we have. It'll be really interesting to see how we solve this one.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Doug, we've had a lot of arguments over healthcare and insurance in this company. Have we been paying enough attention to the issue of how much prescriptions cost?
I don't think so. You know, my company, I've spent the last 6 years trying to make sure consumers know how much it costs when they show up at the pharmacy, and we have a long way to go.
Doug, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Doug Hirsch, co-founder and co-CEO of GoodRx, a website and mobile app that tracks prescription drug prices. It also offers coupons for medications. He joins us to talk about the costs of prescription medications as the Trump administration drafts an executive order targeting drug prices. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. 20 years ago this week, the world was introduced to Harry Potter, Boy Wizard, with the publication of the first book in the series, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. And it wasn't just Harry Potter. It was the whole world of wizarding that Rowling created, complete with magical creatures, spells, and the Hogwarts School of witchcraft and wizarding.
For a lot of people, the Harry Potter books reminded them how much fun reading could be. And far from being the stuff only kids would like, grown-ups flocked to the books in droves. The publisher even released alternate covers so adults wouldn't be embarrassed to be caught reading them on the bus. Here's a taste of that first book.
You're a wizard, Harry.
I'm a what?
A wizard. And a thumping good one, I'd wager, once you trade up a little.
No, you've made a mistake. I mean, I can't be a wizard.
Holly Hassel joins us now to talk about 20 years of Harry Potter. She is a professor of English and Women's Studies at UW Marathon County and is the co-creator of the Wizarding Academy Camp in Wausau. She's also co-author of the book, The Critical Companion to J.K. Rowling. Holly, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, Holly, can you believe that it has been 20 years since that first Harry Potter book was published?
It is hard to believe that it's been that long. For me, I didn't necessarily come of age reading the books. I didn't come to the books until I was a graduate student, actually, getting my PhD in English. And so in some ways, I had a different experience than a lot of the kids who grew up kind of, you know, reading and loving the series. I was able to read and love it and appreciate it as each book was published in those years, but also with a little bit of a critical mindset about it and kind of the analytical perspective as well.
What did get you hooked on Harry Potter? It's not your average grad school reading.
Right, it's true. You know, some of it is, I think, for people like me who decide they want to spend, you know, 10 years of post-secondary education on a graduate degree in English. So what draws us there is that love of literature and that entry into the world of imagination that literature offers. And that's one of the sort of most noteworthy, you know, features of of the book. Well, I will also say that it certainly helped to have some escapist reading when I was getting a PhD in English. And but it really was stunning how, I came to the series after the second book, Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, was published, and found myself just as anxious for the next book to come out as the average, 10-year-old. and, now I'm in a position with my own children to be sharing the books with them. And as you mentioned, the Wizarding Academy that we do here on campus can relive that enthusiasm every year with new generations of kids who are falling in love with it.
Well, why do you think that these books struck such a nerve with so many people? Huge cross sections of people. You don't all expect to be reading the same book. Something about them just made people want to keep reading. How do you put that into words?
Well, that is a good question. It's a question that people have asked J.K. Rowling herself, and she kind of refuses to answer. And is sort of like, I don't even start thinking about that. She's like, I just, I write what I see as kind of being the natural evolution of the characters and the plot. And once I start, thinking too much about why this or that, I think that she worries that the novels wouldn't be authentic. And this was, of course, when she was still writing the novels. And so I think in some ways it's that kind of authenticity and concern for her characters' natural evolution as people, and the conflicts kind of evolving themselves in the way that they do, is what makes them so appealing, is that you can feel that when you read it. I think the other thing that I'll speculate where J.K. Rowling won't, which is that they tackle these, there's something kind of incredible about the way that she both writes these books in an accessible way that 8-year-olds, sometimes 6-year-olds, are reading, as well as graduate students and teachers and parents and your average person, in terms of the characters that she develops, the way that she her style, the kind of the dialogue and the voices that she creates of each of these characters, but also the themes that she addresses in these books. This was something that you kind of see happen over the course of the series, is that she doesn't shy away from complicated or even weighty themes. Harry Potter, right away, he's an orphan, right? And so kids are confronting right away with the book that he's lost his parents. He's living in an abusive household, essentially. I think the fact that she doesn't try to avoid talking about those serious issues that kids and any reader faces is one of the things that makes it really appealing, in addition to the fact that she tackles, themes that everybody struggles with, that Harry's main concern is sort of his finding his place, right? I mean, he has sort of felt out of place up until the point when he gets his Hogwarts letter, and then the series is kind of him trying to make sense of who he is and what his goals are and kind of growing, and this is something that certainly young readers are all tackling, so I think that's at least explains the appeal for a lot of the younger readers.
We're talking to Holly Hassel from UW-Marathon County. She's a professor and Harry Potter expert there. It's the 20th anniversary this week of the first publication of the first Harry Potter book. Can you share a favorite moment or two with us from the books and or the movie adaptations, Holly?
Sure. I'll say one of my favorite books by far, the one that I return to over and over again, is the fourth, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. And I don't know if that's because it was just sort of at the height of the Pottermania, kind of craze, or if it was because where things started to get really, really complicated for Harry, and also because I just sort of like that that's where he really starts to confront some of his own flaws, some of his own challenges, and as well as the kind of archetypal, evil figure of Voldemort. And so for me, some of the really powerful scenes are the Triwizard Tournament. I like that he's confronting these challenges and he's really figuring out who he is and he's having his mettle tested. And so, I think that's something that we can all relate to, is the way that he's faced with these pressures, that he's not sure if he's going to be able to meet everybody's expectations. And I think the scene where he's he's doing the underwater challenge where he has to rescue these people that he cares about, and he also has to make a choice about whether he cares about winning more than he cares about these people that he loves. And, you know, of course, because he's our hero, he chooses the people that he loves more than winning, but in the end, there's this, you know, recognition of a kind of a good world in which he's not punished for that. He's rewarded for the fact that he did the right thing. And so I think that message is kind of comforting for readers, is that, you know, sometimes the easy thing isn't the right thing. And we see him getting kind of valued for that.
Well, Harry is definitely a hero, but there are lots of other heroes in the books. And to some people, the bigger hero is Hermione Granger. Here's a clip of her.
Look who's here.
Ah, come to see the show.
You foul, loathsome, evil little cockroach.
Hermione, no. He's not worth it.
Malfoy, you okay?
Let's go.
And that is the sound of Draco Malfoy's nose being punched by Hermione Granger in the movie. This is a cool... I feel bad saying that. She punches the guy. But it's kind of a cool scene in the movie. This is where Buckbeak the Hippogriff is about to be executed. I could go deeper than that, but we'll leave it there. But let's talk about Hermione. She's a powerful female character, whip smart. How important was she as a role model for girls and for everybody to see?
Well, and... yes. I mean, of course, Hermione is absolutely central to the plot. And this is, I think, some of the, you know, as readers, especially girl readers, it was really important to have that, to have Hermione as a character and to be an equally valuable member of that friendship team. She also really, again, like Harry, I think, and this is one of the, getting back to that question of sort of what is it that appeals about this book, is that she's not a static character, right? She starts presented as a sort of, you know, quote unquote, uptight and bossy. And if you read the first, you know, in the first book, there's this sense of her as being very officious and following the rules too carefully. And then over the course of the books, we see her really evolve and grow. And she still keeps that passion, that enthusiasm that she has for social justice, like with her campaign for elvish rights. But she also becomes this kind of force that they depend on, this the knowledge, the competence, the expertise, the power of that is definitely central to the plot line. And so it's not, we don't get a sense that she's sort of a, you know, secondary character or not as important as Harry. She plays a really central role in the whole narrative.
We're talking to Holly Hassel right now. She's a professor of English and Women's Studies at UW-Marathon County and also a Harry Potter expert. And she's with us now to talk about the 20th anniversary. If you can believe, it's been 20 years since the first publication of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking about the 20th anniversary of the publication of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. And we're talking with Holly Hassel right now, professor of English and Women's Studies at UW-Marathon County, also the co-author of the book The Critical Companion to J.K. Rowling.
You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Are you or have you ever been a Harry Potter fan? Have you reread the books, maybe shared them with the next generation? How do the movies stack up compared to the books? And as a parent, a teacher, a kid, or just a reading grown-up, tell us what you thought of the books. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's go ahead and take our first caller. Now we've got David on the line in Hudson. Hi, David.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. How about you?
Good. I'm doing well. I have so many different things I could choose for, like, amazing memories from this series.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up with this series. I was 17 years old when the last movie finally came out in theaters. I went and saw it, and I, like, as the movie ended, it just came on this dawning realization for me that, like, I had been, like, growing up with this story, and I learned so many things and morals of, like, love and peace and acceptance. And then, like, it finally ended for me, and as, like, this last scene, like, faded out, I, like, started bawling and was basically just like, that's my childhood. Like, it's gone. It's done. And that was something that was really emotional for me because it was just something I grew up with, and I fit in with so many of the characters. Hermione's my favorite. I felt like her So I was always a rule follower, and it's just like, I felt like Hogwarts was home, and that sounds really cheesy, but it was true.
No, I get it. I totally get it, David. Thank you for that. And I'm sure that David is not alone in feeling that and feeling like you've grown up and these characters are kind of your family and they reflect you and they've taught you. What do you think about David's story, Holly?
I think there are so many readers that relate to the comments that he shared. And it does get to this question of what is it about these stories? And I think David's comments hit on it, and to at least part of it, which is the kind of the rich secondary world that she's created, right? That there's so much, I guess what we English types call verisimilitude, right? That it's like it seems true to life, even though she's using this completely imaginary fantasy environment. And so it's almost like you're kind of occupying this completely different world where so many things are possible, at the same time as there's a connection to some of these everyday themes that many readers are going to face, like coming of age and finding your place and navigating difficulties with family. And at the same time, there's these fantastic details that she's created that make you feel like you're really there.
David, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Tia in Cumberland. Tia, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think about the Harry Potter books?
Well, they came to us at a very unusual time in my children's life. They were 10 and 8, and I had just had a baby. And so they were feeling a little displaced and feeling a lot of upheaval. We had moved into a new home. And my mother sent us the book and said, I want you to sit down with the girls every night and read aloud together. This is a great story. You're going to love it. And so my children grew up with Harry Potter. And I feel that it really retied our bonds to each other and brought them a sense of that everything was going to be okay and that everyone faces these unusual hurdles in life and you don't know where it's going to take you, but it all ends up working out in the end if you're true to yourself.
Tia, thanks a lot for sharing that story. And that makes me think, Holly, it isn't just the relationship between the reader and the book in this, but people came together, whether they're reading to each other or talking about the books or lining up at the midnight bookstore opening for the new book, whatever. This is kind of a communal experience, the Harry Potter books.
That's exactly right. And I'm so glad to hear Tia's story, because I think that was another feature of this series that really is one of the factors that made it so phenomenal is, you know, we had our kind of classic books that a lot of families like to read together, you know, the things that Rowling drew from, like the Tolkien novels, The Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, and C.S. Lewis, The Chronicles of Narnia. Some of those series that, you know, I think still do persist in you know, reading households that like to sort of spend time reading out loud to each other. And Harry Potter was just a kind of another entry in that series. As someone who was, you know, a parent of a child who at the time that Harry Potter, when I was first able to introduce it to her, she was very into a series called The Rainbow Magic Fairies, which was essentially, I don't know, 78 books with almost all the same plot. And I remember reading these out loud every night and thinking, oh my gosh, when, and so it was just like refreshing and wonderful when we finally got to the point where I could read Harry Potter. And it just was such a, you know, when now as an adult reader, I could really share in the excitement that of the plotting and the character development in a way that was, intergenerational.
Well, Tia, thanks a lot for that. And we'll go next to Julie joining us in Milwaukee. Julie, hi.
Hi. Well, I'm a lot older than a lot of the Harry Potter audience. I am 66, and a friend of mine, who we both were in professional theater, urged me to read the first book, and I didn't want to. And she said, no, please, I want you to read this and talk about it with me, because she said, this is fabulous. So I did. What I didn't know is that my friend was dying of cancer, and she didn't tell anybody for a long time. But she didn't live through the writing of book four, but we devoured books one through three and talked about them constantly. How would we stage them? What would the costumes look like? She was a costume designer. We had so much fun with these books, and she always saw herself as Severus Snape. But I could make a Halloween costume for myself. And, of course, we didn't know at that time, you know, that it would be Rickman in the
Alan Rickman
role. And he was, thank you, and a favorite actor of both of ours. And you know, so this, every time I watch the movies or flip through a book, I just relive the time, really precious time spent with my friend. And the books themselves are more than that kind of a vehicle. I mean, they stand on their own. But if it hadn't been for her, I don't know if I would have read the first one.
Oh, that is such a beautiful story, Julie. Thank you for sharing that. So much, you know, love and laughter I can hear in your voice, and that the gift again of Harry Potter bringing people together and bringing so much joy into lives like that. Holly, stories like that where there is something deeper going on besides the books themselves, but they're almost a vehicle for people to come together. And like Tia was talking about earlier, that the bond of love that people have reading together. I hear that.
Yeah, and I love that Julie brought up Severus Snape, because he's a character that people, readers experienced in kind of complicated ways. And I mean, without saying a lot about the plotline, just that over time we as readers came to see that characters are complicated for lots of reasons. And it was makes me think of this research study that I just read that was looking at the cultivation of empathy for kids, and how reading fiction, and in particular the Harry Potter novels, is a strategy for helping kids cultivate empathy. And by empathy, I mean just the ability to see and understand how someone else thinks and why they might, the experiences they might have had that sort of drive what their choices are. And I think that Rowling's novels just do that beautifully, is they have these characters who, on first glance, you may think, well, wow, you know, they sure seem, unlikable, or I can't understand at all why someone would do that. And then she, you know, has this really skillful way of letting those characters unfold, and then you finally see the rationale behind their actions, and you have to rethink your initial stance. And so I think that's a really kind of skillful thing she does as a writer.
Thanks again for sharing that story. We'll go next to Ben, calling from here in Wisconsin. Ben, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Ben?
I wanted to talk about how the Harry Potter series is really inspiring to me, because when my friend first introduced me into the books, that I thought they were kind of a waste of time. But once I started reading them, they inspired me to be different and think out of the box.
And can I ask how old you are, Ben?
I'm 10 years old.
10 years old. Wow. Thank you so much, Ben, for calling and sharing the story. So Ben inspired as a 10-year-old to see that it's okay to stand out and not be like everybody else, Holly.
Yeah, that's right, and that's definitely a message we don't even just get from Harry Potter as a character. We see that in the characters of Ron and Hermione, and I think of Luna Lovegood, who really embraces her eccentricity. That is definitely a message in the books that I think kids leave with, is to kind of embrace their own quirks and embrace their strengths, and if it's not, you know, kind of what everybody else would do, then that's okay. That's just great.
Holly, just a few seconds left now, but J.K. Rowling, it's been a long time since the last Harry Potter book came out. She's written some other stuff and some nibbles on the edge of the Harry Potter universe. But do you hope that she writes another huge Harry Potter universe series, or do you think that we have enough?
I'm a kind of a purist in the sense that I think that the series stands alone as what it is, and there's a kind of like coherent beauty to what it is now. And so if she were to write another series of books, I don't know that I'd want them to be Harry's story, because I think we know Harry's story, and it's wonderful and engaging and inspiring. And so if she does decide to do that again, and I've read some interviews with her where she says, you know, if she ever did return to the Harry Potter world, she'd probably take up somebody else's story. And I think it's an interesting enough world where there's lots of characters that she could really tell their stories.
Holly, thank you so much for joining us. That was Holly Hassel, professor of English and Women's Studies at UW-Marathon County, talking about the 20th anniversary of Harry Potter.